I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome this hour. Before we begin this part of our conversation today, there have been a lot of rumors flying around about Michael Jackson that have been heard. Some people that we've heard said that he had a heart attack and died, but nobody knows that for sure yet. The latest news that we received from The Wire is that Michael Jackson was unconscious, and he was rushed to UCLA Medical Center by paramedics. And as soon as we know more, and as soon as alert comes up, I will let you all know. We hope he survives whatever happened to him, and we'll let you know as soon as we know more, since we've had some calls and people have been asking, and we've heard rumors flying back and forth, but that's what we know at this point. So now we're going to get to the heart of our show. We were going to start our show with General Baker from an auto worker. We are having a hard time getting through to him, and as soon as we do, we'll probably put that towards the end of our hour so we can have this conversation with General Baker in a very unique perspective on what's going on in Detroit with the auto workers from the perspective of an auto worker himself. But what we're going to talk about now is really something very fascinating. Over the years, we have done a number of programs and stories with people who have been victims of trauma and torture from around the world, and their healing process and how they get to that place. And Baltimore is a center for that. And people come here from across the world. And there's an organization in Baltimore called Art on Purpose that was created by Peter Brune. And it takes the world of art and puts it and makes it into a social action tool, a political change tool, a device to heal and heal our world, heal human beings in it, and heal the world in general. And one of those people who's involved in that is Julie Lynn, who's was an Art on Purpose resident community artist from 2008 to 2009. And she started engaging herself and working with this group called Advocates for Survivors of Torture and Trauma, who have been guests on the show before, and did a series of workshops that were built around women who come from all over the world. It was a process of healing around artwork and food and recipes and stories of meals and families and their home countries and works of art that they created and a multimedia that Julie created. So I expanded those activities to work with the Refugee Assistance Program, International Rescue Committee, and Adelante Familia. So they had their opening last Saturday, and we have asked, we wanted to have them on to talk about their work, and she joins us in studio right now, along with Inas, who is from Baghdad, who now lives in northeast Baltimore. And Inas and Julie Lynn, welcome. Good to have you on the air with us.
Thank you, Mark, for inviting us.
It's a pleasure to have you both in the studio.
Thank you.
Good. That second voice was Inas, that first voice was Julie. Number here is 410-319-8888 to join in on this conversation. So, Julie, talk a bit about this. I'm always so fascinated by the numbers of artists in our community, especially people come out of MICA for whatever reason they came out of MICA this way, that are incredible artists, but their art is also part of changing this world, and not just to have a piece of canvas or a piece of artwork hanging or living someplace, but something that actually affects and lives with human beings.
Yeah, I feel that art can be a reflection of what's going on in the world. And for me, this was a very special project for me. I love to cook, and I wanted to make something. I wanted to do a project where I can combine cooking and art making as well. And I looked at my community. From a previous Art on Purpose project, we learned a lot about immigrants and the Baltimore community. So I wanted to find a project where I can combine all these three elements. And I'm also a collage artist.
Uh-huh.
So I take a lot of images from the world, whether it's photographs, and I combine that together and create my own art. And I thought that's a metaphor for the immigrant experience as well. When you're an immigrant, you are straddling two different worlds, and you're taking bits and pieces from those two worlds and creating your own world.
So talk about your approach to this. First, I'm curious about your collage work. Does that mean like you're working with all kinds of materials? I mean, is it work that hangs? Is it work that sits in a video? I mean, what is your work?
Well, I experiment in a lot of different ways, but right now my primary materials are 2D. So I create canvases where I take photographs or photocopies of plants and herbs and vegetables, and I collage that onto a canvas. And then I paint on it and create a landscape with that.
So the work you're doing now, the work you started doing with the survivors of advocates for survivors of torture and trauma, talk about how that started and what drew you to this, or what helped you create this? What drew you into this world?
Into the world.
Just that you started doing this work.
Well, I learned about ASTT at a fundraiser a couple years ago, and I was really intrigued by what they do. ASTT provides mental and support to people who have survived torture and trauma. And so I thought a lot about the healing process and how art making can be very healing as well. So I made connections with the organization, and we talked a little bit about different ideas and proposed this Kitchen Stories project.
So what was it? I mean, what did you propose?
So what I did with this project was we did a series of workshops. We held 12 workshops at ASTT, and where the participants came in and we talked about food, we talked about memories of home, and we created artworks as well in response to that. So, for example, we made collages that illustrate the recipes that we talked about in the classes. And then we also used artworks as a forum for them to tell stories about their journey and stories about their family and memories.
So, was this the part of the project you were part of?
Yes.
So tell us a bit about yourself. You're from Baghdad.
Yes, I'm from Baghdad, and I'm here in America for 7 months now. Me and my husband are now here in America after what happened in Iraq, after the bad situation, the unsafe situation. So it's like we apply for the UN, then UN bring us here. And since we arrived here, everyone here was really helpful, especially the IRC, and IRC is the organization that helped us. And
it's the International Rescue Committee. Is that who that is?
Exactly. Yeah, everyone there was really helpful, because you know, as new arrival here to America, we don't know how to deal with the American lives, how to live their life. So there were lots of people help us a lot. And in the IRC, I met Julie. I was there in one of her workshops. Then I have been invited to the next and third. And workshops was really good, good time to spend. We were talking about cooking, as she said, cooking memories, and how to serve others. For me, I really love cooking. I love art. I already draw since age seven.
In Baghdad, when you were a child, you drew.
Yeah, I even like were in competitions, and I remember that I have the bronze medal at that time. Yeah, and it's the medal back there in Iraq.
So stay in Iraq.
Yeah, stay
you didn't
in
have
Iraq.
Time to take it.
No, not time. Yeah, and for me, as I love cooking. I love to cook when I cook, I will know that the people that I will serve, my family or my husband, they will always love to like my cook or love to being served from me. Like, so.
The recipe you have in the book sounds amazing, which we'll get to in a minute. But
it is.
Do you want to say something, Julie? Go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that for these workshops, cooking was our entree into the conversation. We it's cooking and eating. It's a really non-threatening way to start conversations. So we began a lot of the workshops by talking about special memories, special meals, with friends and families, foods that you might miss from your homeland, and just a lot of these kind of discussions to kind of get the...
Well, these women that I read about in this workshop, they came from all over Latin America. They came from Rwanda. They came from Iraq. They came from countries across the world.
Bhutan, Burma,
From Burma.
Yeah.
Some of whom had fled violence, but some of whom had experienced some pretty horrible things in their own lives.
Yes.
So I'm curious, before I talk more about your world in Baghdad, because I want to hear your story more, Inas, but is how do these conversations between women and their cooking and their recipes and their stories help to heal people? I mean, we think of that, doing that, just people do that normally. That's what we do, right? So what was that process that helped people heal through these things?
Well, for people like Inez, cooking is relaxing and therapeutic. And she can kind of talk about what, you know, she's thinking or not thinking when you're cooking. Maybe you can imagine standing over the stove, stirring a pot, and all the things that may go through your mind, you know, whether it's relaxing or not.
Yes, this is right. And cooking for me is something where I'm really proud of, because I already learned how to cook from my mom. I always watch my mom. But since age, I think 20, I started to become like more better than my mom. And yeah, everyone just loves my recipe, loves my cook, how to cook stuff or how to make stuff. So I'm really proud of this.
So so in this workshop, you have all these women, and I was reading about some of the women in the workshop in the study, and I will say the recipes all look incredibly good, and I just really upset that I didn't get to the workshop to eat some of the stuff you were cooking. But I'm really deeply concerned about how, I mean, what came out of these workshops?
Yeah.
What beyond the recipes, how did that affect people profoundly in terms of working through what happened to them? The fact that they're here in a new country.
Well, this is where the art making element came into place.
Mm-hmm.
In addition to talking, sharing stories, collecting recipes, we also made artworks at these workshops. We either made collages or we did drawings about these topics. And for a lot of these participants, this was their first time making artwork. And so I think they left the workshops understanding that art can be a way to express themselves and giving voice to their story. So I think this project did that. They allowed them to kind of have a voice.
Could you talk a bit about how that happened? How it gave people a voice?
How? Well, through conversations and just the stories that we've collected. And the stories are on display right now at the Library Project in Federal Hill.
Mm-hmm.
And so... these are stories that people may have never heard or have a chance to share. So it's a visual way. And
are there stories that affected you that you can remember from this project?
Oh yeah, definitely.
Share some of them maybe with us.
Yeah, I made 4 artworks in responses to my experience teaching the participants, and a lot of the artworks are inspired by the stories. For example, I have a piece that's called Still Standing.
Oh, yes,
that's
right.
In the show.
Mm-hmm.
And this painting has these beautiful organic-looking plants and 2 plants that kind of stick out of the middle of the composition. So it looks a lot to me like figures. So it's sort of a metaphor for figures,
and the wood,
as well.
The pieces of wood, I mean, I guess they're old.
Uh-huh.
Stumps and trees and driftwood look like figures of human beings.
Yes, exactly. It's actually ginger root, but it has a very dried texture, which looks shriveled and old and aged. And that was intentional. This was inspired by 2 participants that I met through these workshops who had to flee their home because of war. And they had to survive by themselves, just living off the land and living, you know, and hiding from their enemies.
And this was Cecile and Louise who came from Rwanda.
Yes.
Then they did they live through the genocide?
Yeah, yeah. So, so this painting is an homage to that experience and the story that I heard from them. The story really touched me, and I really wanted to make an artwork about that.
I mean, the story here itself, I mean, is a pretty amazing story. I mean, Louise's story that she was tortured by the military, and who knows what else happened to her.
And as a cause of that, she is disabled. And so now she struggles with, you know, her disability, but also struggling with trying to learn English and trying to, you know, live in America.
I met somebody from Rwanda at another program that we did who talked about what happened to them in Rwanda during the genocide. And it was a story of hiding in a box hidden in the earth in their hut, watching their grandmother being killed by a neighbor who they had raised, and the neighbor was Hutu and they were Tutsi, but they grew up as brother and sister and watched this person mm-hmm. then kill some of them. I mean, we're talking about people who witnessed these kinds of...
Yeah, and so it was very inspirational for me to hear these stories of survival, and I was really inspired by the journey and their heroic act.
You know, so tell me just a bit about, before we go back to some of the other kinds of works of art and people that are in this workshop and what happened to them, I'd like to know more about you and how it is that you came to flee Baghdad and why you left.
As I told you, after the war, the situation was really bad. Really bad, like not safe even to walk on the street. There's always and everywhere just women's go to work, go to shop, always women's, because men's really like someone will kill them for sure. Or
we kill the men.
Yeah. Even kids, even teenagers, when it just man, that mean his life is really, really dangerous. And it was not safe. And really, what's really funny, what's happened in Iraq, it's for sure it's not from the Iraqis.
Pardon me, I'm sorry.
Yes, not from the Iraqis. Because when you heard a lot of difference, these differences are always in the same family, and it's okay to live with this, even in the same family. So, like, my family, there's a lot of difference in my family, and...
What do you mean by difference? You're talking about Shiite Sunni?
Yes, this is... Yeah, this is really... since age, this is not something bad. Like, in my family, my mom is Sunni, my father is Shia.
Okay.
Yeah, and they already related. They already, like... he's already her cousin.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the Iraqi life. This is the Iraqi people. But what's happened, it was not from, it's like from outside. Yeah, lots of members start just like trying to have a share, to take a role in this country. You know, it's like family in Iraq. The father is the base of the family. After the war, the situation was like family without a father. Anyone started to be the big head, the
mm-hmm.
yeah, responsible of everything.
So what happened to you? I mean, so why did your husband and you decide? What was going on at the moment that you, to the two of you and to people around you that, you decided it was time to go?
At the end of 06, 2006, it was really bad situation. My husband already, like, they tried to kill him twice. They shot him in his leg once.
They shot your husband?
Yeah, but this was before we got married.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, in his legs, and it's still like the parts of the bullets in his leg. So the second time, they just, like, tried to take him from home, but just God helped him, and he ran out. After this, we decided to travel to Syria, like almost the Iraqis.
So you became a refugee in Syria?
Yes, But in Syria, you can't live because you're not allowed to work. And it's like stopped life. If you can work, you will just spend what you have, and there's no future. From there, we applied for the UN. The UN to like to help us to take us into another country, just another part of the world. After I think 1 year, they accept us in America.
That was, I mean, you were one of the, in a sense, one of the lucky ones in that many Iraqis haven't been able to come to America.
Yeah.
It's been hard.
Yes, really, really hard. And there is still now thousands of Iraqis waiting as a refugee in Syria, waiting to come to America or another country just to live, to start another life, a new life.
So so who, when you were back home in Baghdad,
mm-hmm.
who was, who shot your husband? Who was after, who was after him and after?
What's really weird, we don't know.
We don't know.
Like other,
that's even more frightening. You don't know.
Yeah, like lots of other young guys has been killed, and no one know who's killed them.
So what was that like for you and your friends and family and your husband to live in that kind of world? You were describing to me before we came into the studio.
Yeah.
Just about what it was like to live in Baghdad in that kind of fear.
It's like you said, it's fear. It's like there's no future. There's no even tomorrow. We can't trust that there's tomorrow. Anytime, maybe you will lost one of your friends, one of your family, and this is really terrible.
It's very traumatic.
Yeah.
So, and you've been here for 7 months?
7 months, yeah.
So Julie Lynn, I mean, we're talking mm-hmm. this part of our program today with two people who are part of this incredible project called Kitchen Stories. Kitchen Stories can be seen and heard, seen not heard, but seen, at the Library Project, 1401 Light Street in South Baltimore, which they now call Federal Hill. They can be seen in South Baltimore. And it is a story that Julie Lynn, an artist and a community artist who put this project together, with people who were victims from the Advocates for Survivors of Torture and Trauma and other groups, and to tell the stories of women telling their own stories through their stories of their homeland, through their cooking, through their recipes of who they are, and what this trauma and terror they went through became. And then Julie also created works of art with them around that. And Julie Lynn is in the studio with us, along with Inas, who is from Baghdad and now lives here in Northeast Baltimore. And most of these women now live in Baltimore as well. Julie, go ahead.
And I just wanted to add, we had a couple of men participate in the class as well. It's interesting, some of the men from Africa have, now that they're living here, they have to learn how to cook. And
So men in your groups as well, not just women?
Yes, a handful, yeah, three.
Three?
Yeah. Yeah, but it was interesting that for them, the class also became a life skills group where we, they interacted with other people, but also talking about food and everything piqued their interests to learn about how to cook. Now that they're here in America, they have to take care of themselves and no longer had someone to help them cook. So that was interesting to note. And the other thing too is, in the exhibition and in the catalog, you'll hear some of the stories, the horrendous story that some of these participants had to live through. But in the workshops, we also talked a lot about happy memories as well. So I, don't want to focus on exclusively.
I think that's important. We'll take a short break, but I'm going to come right back from this break. I mean, I think it's important that we talk a bit about, people went through trauma and torture, but it's also the joy of remembrance of a wonderful life that existed beyond and before that. We'll be right back. Join us here at 410-319-8888. And we're talking about one more remarkable project worked on through art on purpose to help transform lives in our community through art and dialogue. We'll be right back. 410-319-8888. Stay with us. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and we have a very interesting conversation going on here. I'd love to have you join us at 410-319-8888. I want to remind you, the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ was formed in 1936 to help people during the Great Depression. And over 70 years later, they're still here to help people during difficult times. More information is available at mecu.com. We are joined in the studio right now by Julie Lin, who is an artist and a community activist, a community artist who has begun a number of projects. We're talking about the one she began with advocates for survivors of torture and trauma, a series of workshops built around stories, recipes of food and cooking, and talking about families in the home countries and women coming together, mostly women, going through a very deep and personal healing process that also ended up in a community artwork and in Julie Lin's artwork in this multimedia form that can all be seen now at the Library Project at 1401 Light Street. Julie will be talking about these kitchen stories this Saturday on June 27th at 2 p.m. at the Library Project. And on July 25th, there's a closing reception for Kitchen Stories featuring a potluck of international dishes, and that should get you there as well. The number here is 410-319-8888. One of the women in that project is Inas, who is with us. She's from Baghdad. Just a few minutes ago told us her story about life in Baghdad. You can join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. So where did we leave off? You said something at the end about the kind of the power of the joy of the story is not always the pain.
Exactly. The class was an opportunity for the participants to kind of forget some of the bad things and just focus on the art making and relax and enjoy the company. So it was a way for them to escape as well.
So now what about the food?
Yes. Yes, at these classes.
What about the food?
At these workshops, we held potlucks. So people would bring in things, and we would share recipes and eat and just enjoy ourselves.
So now, talk about, I'm going to come back to some of the stories, some of the other women. I would like to kind of share some of the stories that were in this project and what people talked about. But how did you see your kind of cooking as being part of healing for you and these other women?
Cooking is really help me to, like, if I'm upset of something, I will cook, then eat what I cook. It's really relaxing.
I understand, right.
It's really relaxing, especially when I know that I will serve, like, my friend, my family, my husband, and when I do the recipes that he loves, this really make me feel good.
So you have in here, when you have a couple of recipes in here that I've never had.
Yeah.
Topsy, is that how you say it?
Topsy, yeah.
Topsy.
Topsy means it's not the recipe, it's the pan that we will serve in.
Oh.
So this is, as in the book, there is eggplants topsy, there is potato tepsi, there's chicken tepsi. Yeah.
But it must be difficult for women to come together and kind of bring these dishes to life in a different country. I mean, just finding the ingredients, let alone.
Yeah, we had a lot of interesting conversations about that. You know, I asked a lot of the participants, like, why does the food that you try to create here in America taste different? And there's a myriad of reasons why, you know, some of the ingredients are not available here in America. Some people say it's the water makes the things taste different. We talk a lot about those maybe reasons why. And there's also the emotional aspect of eating as well. Like Inez was saying, you know, you cook for the people that you love. And when you are here, maybe if you're eating alone, it's not quite the same as if you were eating, you know, with your family back home.
So I wonder, Julia, but when you do these projects, what do you walk away with? I mean, this is a lovely book, there are great, phenomenal pictures, and we'll talk about some of the things that the people that drew, and there's some pictures that Inas drew in this as well, and others. But before we, beyond that, I mean, what is it that you walk away with this from? I mean, then what is it that you come away with from doing this work?
A lot of different things. One of the things that I learned from this project is that there are a lot more similarities among cultures than there are differences. And that's really wonderful to see. And it's reflected in the culture. It's in the food and just people. You know, we're all humans and we all need to eat.
But I mean, when you started this, it was clearly more than just doing artwork and cooking. Mm-hmm. You came, you could have done that with any group. You could have done that anywhere. You could have done it with the people we went to Micah with, but you chose to do this in this way.
Yeah, I wanted to work with the immigrant and refugee community, and because I like to use art to empower people. So I thought this was a underserved community that I wanted to give voice.
Tell me about your philosophy about how that works. How does art empower community? I'm curious what it might then what it might have done for you, Enos, and how different you were when you walked in and maybe left this project. So how does art empower community for you? What does it do? As an artist, how do you approach that?
What do you mean?
As an artist, if you want to take your artwork into a group of people who have fled their homelands to come to a different place, some of them out of fear, some of them out of being tortured, some of them being raped and abused, their lives turned upside down. So, I mean, when you decide to do this, what is it about your art and the art itself you think that touches and changes people like this? I mean, clearly something came out of this for you.
Right. Yeah. Well, for me, it was also a way for me to investigate some of the motifs that I've been using in my artworks. Mm-hmm. For example, I've been using imagery of nests in some of my previous artworks. And so this really made me, give me an opportunity to really dig deep into myself and wonder, you know, to look at why I was using this type of imagery. And the nest imagery, is symbolic for rebirth, metamorphosis. And it's a lot like, you know, the immigrant experience. You're coming to a new country and you're creating a new life. So so it was enlightening for myself personally as well and for my art.
So what about you? I mean, you walked into this. Why did you do this in the first place? And how did it change you?
At first I did these things. It's good to have friends, new friends, to share their stories, to know how they did in their lives or how what they want to do as a new things. And it's really give me lots of like self, make me trust myself more to be in these workshops, have new friends. For example, after the workshop, it's like I'm here, I'm talking on the radio. Before this, I don't know why I could do this.
You're doing very well.
Yeah.
Maybe you should get a job in radio.
Oh, no, I'm not. No, I'm not.
So, I mean, that's interesting. I mean, and what changes did you see in the other women around you in that workshop?
A lot of women became like more, I don't know how to say it, more friendly, more speak a lot of their experiences. More than first, they have like it's okay with them to share their sad stories or what they had in their countries. It's like became more strong than before.
Yeah, we saw a lot of the women open up throughout the course of the workshops, and you know, they might come into the first class feeling very shy and quiet, but then they would start talking, you know, into the workshops. So that was really wonderful to see.
And that must have been amazing. I mean, just the idea of having all these women from all these different places. I thought you were going to say something. So there was another woman from Iraq in this group as well, right?
Yes. Sosan?
Sosan.
Yeah. She's really good cooker. She's a really good speaker. She's a friendly guy. friendly woman.
Well, this has been just an amazing story, and I look forward to seeing the closing reception on July 25th at 1401 Light Street for Kitchen Stories. This Saturday, June 27th at 2 p.m., Julie Lynn will be there to give a talk about Kitchen Stories at 1401 Light Street. And you want to give a website out or something?
Yes. And also, tomorrow, Friday, ASTT is having a fundraiser event. It is from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Library Project. And so it's a great way to come out and support the wonderful organizations that I partnered with. In addition to ASTT, this project, we also worked with three other organizations, and they are the International Rescue Committee, Adelante Familia, and Refugee Assistance Program, which is based in BCCC.
This has been fascinating. I think the work you all are doing are amazing. It was wonderful to meet both of you, and I appreciate you taking the time on the air with us today.
Thank you.
And we'll see you down in the library.
Yes, come visit, good. And we'll have some great food together.
Yeah, some food, and I'm going to try your recipes.
Yeah, you should be there. We will cook a lot.
Okay, that sounds good.
Yeah.
And I'll come to your workshop and cook with you one day.
That's good.
I like that. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Good to have you here.
Thank you.
So we're going to switch gears here and talk about something affecting America right now. We're going to talk about what's going on in Detroit and the auto industry. But from the worker's perspective, and General Baker, who's a longtime auto worker activist and retired auto worker, led many movements and wildcat strikes in the 60s, will join us here in about 30 seconds. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. Before we start this conversation with General Baker, I just want to give you an update on the news. As we promised, Michael Jackson did die. He passed away just this afternoon, brought to a hospital unconscious, and apparently had a heart attack. I don't know exactly if that's true, but if we know more at the end of the hour, we will let you know, and we wanted to give you that news. And now we are talking with General Baker. General Baker is a nationally, internationally known labor leader who was an auto worker for 40 years. He was he fought against the system many times, led wildcat strikes, was a founder of movements in Detroit. He's retired and lives in Detroit. He wrote a very interesting piece in the People's Tribune and was interviewed by them and looked at what's going on with the auto industry, but from a worker's perspective. And General Baker, pleasure to talk to you. How are you?
Listen, Mark, it's a pleasure to talk to you this evening.
It's been a long time. It's good to hear your voice again.
Hey, likewise, Mark.
That's great. Our dear old friend Michael Brand is listening in. He's was excited to hear you were going to be on the show today.
Oh, fantastic. You got to say hello to him for me.
I will do that.
Okay, that's great.
So let's talk a bit about I used your the piece that you wrote about Detroit the other day in our conversation about the economy, because I think people do not understand that what has happened to the auto industry from the perspective of the workers who work in those factories.
You're absolutely right. And, Mark, one of the problems we have is when this crisis broke, we were surprised to see how it seemingly how hated the auto worker is. People from all over the country just had a lot of disdain for auto workers, and we found ourselves in a battle trying to defend ourselves. You know, first they were talking about how the auto worker makes $76 an hour, and I don't know where they got that figure from. but when I hired into the auto industry back in 1963, I made $2.62 an hour making Mustangs.
How much did you make?
$2.64 an hour making parts for the Mustang in 1963.
Uh-huh.
So all during the years, I mean, we've seen some pay increases. But nothing like $70 an hour, which is an attempt for those that hate the auto industry and hate the auto worker, trying to tag on all of the legacy costs of the retirees into the pay of the actual auto worker. You know, so the figure they're giving is really inflated and really a misnomer and inappropriate. Nobody else. I mean, if you ask a state employee what he makes, they don't take the pay of all of the retired state workers and their health care and add that to his to his salary and tell you that's what he makes. But that's precisely what they were doing with the auto worker, trying to mislead people on what kind of money we made. So we started off with a real big problem, Mark, just trying to defend ourselves on what the wages of the auto worker was. And most of that is legacy costs. And that's because, listen, General Motors has 400,000 retirees. Chrysler has 200,000. Ford has about 300,000.
Wow.
And if you take the transplants, Toyota has 300. I mean, so how are we going to match the wages? And Toyota got 300 retirees, and we got almost 600,000, you know, out of the other big three. It's impossible to do that because all these retirees still, you know, have to. We have to worry about their pensions and their health care.
So what?
So it's go ahead.
No. So the question. I want to come back to retirees because what they're losing. We're talking about almost 1 million retired auto workers in America, and what's happened to them. So talk about for a moment. What people don't understand from your perspective about what the auto workers gave up in these companies in these last negotiations since the collapse of the auto industry?
Just this year, the what we gave up has been tremendous. We gave up break time, and I don't know, those are familiar with those assembly lines, man, every minute of break time you can get is treasure. We gave up break time, we gave up pay increases, you know, on cost of living increases, we gave up holiday pay, we gave up Christmas bonuses, we gave up classification differences inside the shop. I think most of the skilled trades jobs were combined, so now you got two trades jobs, one electrical and one mechanical, and all the trades fit within that category. We even got one situation in which a skilled trades worker can now be worked on the production line when there's no trade work being done. We took those, and I think one of the most bitter pills we took was the fact that in both the Chrysler and GM contract, we signed a no-strike clause to the year 2015. Now, nobody has yet been able to tell us how much money that saves somebody by signing a no-strike clause. But we are locked into a no-strike clause for 6 years. So even with the break time and the other cuts we've taken, if this industry rebounds, the active worker is going to really be squeezed, you know, trying to make production, and not going to have the ability to strike. He only can go to binding arbitration, and that's it. So we got a real, real problem inside the shop. And when the shop started back up, not only that, but I was reading in a paper where the Lordstown GM plant is just installed 840 new robots inside the shop that will probably eliminate another 1,600 jobs. And so one of the problems in the auto industry is that manufacturing is so productive. It's so productive that too many cars and trucks are being produced for the amount of the population that can buy them back. And that's one of the problems we got, you know, the increased productivity over the years of the auto plants themselves. So we got a real crisis, and the active auto worker is going to have a real problem when we go back just over the question of what's been lost on the implant day by day.
Now, what do you think happens with this? I mean, when you have the auto industry now being propped up, at least with GM being propped up by the American government, and that retirement is now tied to the stock itself, which is worthless.
Yeah, right.
So, what happens now? Do you think?
Well, see, okay. Let me split the two to tell you.
All right. Okay.
First of all, on the active worker with GM owning the plant, we're not sure how that's going to play out. I know that the government keeps saying that they don't want to have no day-to-day activity in the operation of the plant. They want to act like a hedge fund or something, or some kind of equity interest, and just let these corporate hacks that they put in place run the shop. Well, that's going to be impossible for it to do that way without demanding the government take some action. If these corporations get ready to close plants, you mean with the government owning 75% of it, we're just going to allow them to go ahead and close the plant? You know, so it's going to take some interest and interference on the part of the government in the operation of that. On the retirement front, we got a real, real problem. And that's because we got this new thing called a VEBA account, Voluntary Employment Benefit Account. And this thing is supposed to be funded by the corporation that is a problem to begin with. But in this new section of contracts we went through. Now they're going, Ford Motor Company is going, pay half stock and half cash. GM is almost all stock, and Chrysler is playing almost all equity. So we got a real, real problem. It's rumored that some of these Viva accounts may not hold up 6 years. The Viva account, the way it's going to work, is that the Viva Trust, which is a new body that's being created by the union, will start in 2010. So next January, will now our health care be handled by a Viva Trust. Now, that Viva Trust will have an ability each year to adjust your health benefits of the retirees, based on how much money is in the Viva account, which is a real dangerous trend. We already at Chrysler and GM have lost our optical and our dental. So 600,000 retired auto workers no longer have optical care or dental care starting on July 1st, which is next week.
I mean, that is...
Yes.
I mean, that's almost like madness. I mean, I'm curious what you, I mean, people right now are looking at, we only have about 3 minutes left, Jen, so, people are talking about who oppose on some levels what President Obama is doing with putting money into the General Motors, that they're calling this kind of socialization, nationalization of the industry, but clearly you have a critique from a different end.
Yeah, my critique is that, obviously what we got is better than having the whole thing collapse and it going through a bankruptcy and we got nothing. What we ended up coming out of this was our pension was guaranteed, and I think that wasn't so much a choice of the government. The word is that if the pensions of the auto worker collapsed, it would collapse the entire pension system in America for those drawing defined pensions. So the government didn't have much of a choice on that front. The biggest problem we got is what happened to the health care, though. How are we going to get health care? What we're battling for on this front is battling for national health care. Unless we got the government paying for our health care and no longer relying on an employee to pay into our health care, then that health care is not going to be guaranteed. So that's kind of the focus of the retired section right now, battling for national health care. It's not clear on what the demands of the active section is going to be because the plants are just starting up under the new lead. Chrysler just began to unroll their plants this week. So we're looking at what the demands of the active worker is going to be under these new circumstances. And we won't know what that's going to look like at GM until the GM comes out of bankruptcy and we get back to flowing probably at the end of July or near the end of July before we know precisely what that looks like.
Well, General Baker, I do want to have you back on for a conversation on a roundtable with lots of other people because you bring a perspective on the auto industry that we don't hear enough. And I wish we had more time today. We look forward to having you back very soon.
Hey, Mark, listen, the pleasure is mine. Whenever you call me, I'll be there.
Thank you so much, Jen. Good to talk to you.
Okay, bye-bye.
General Baker, auto worker for 40 years, retired, led many wildcat strikes in the 60s, and it was a pleasure to hear his different point of view. The Mark Steiner Show, Urbanite Stories of the Mark Steiner Show, are made possible by Baltimore Mediation, the first mediation firm in the state of Maryland, specializing in separation and divorce and business and workplace conflicts, located in Baltimore at www.baltimoremediation.com. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Jessica Phillips. We're engineered by Zachary Coleman. Our interns are Judith Lloyd, Brian Boone, Brad Kolodner, and Devin Finley. Our theme music is by Walt Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, hear additional interviews, and read our blogs, visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for Public Radio WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.